In fact, we can use this information to determine whether others are happy to see us or would prefer that we leave them alone. Assume you are approaching two people engaged in a conversation. These are individuals you have met before, and you want to join in the discussion. So you walk up to them and say, "Hi." The problem is that you're not sure if they really want your company. Is there a way to find out? Yes. Watch their feet and torso behavior. If they move their feet, along with their torsos, to admit you, then the welcome is full and genuine. However, if they don't move their feet to welcome you, but instead only swivel at the hips to say hello, then they'd rather be left alone. We tend to turn away from things that we don't like or that are disagreeable to us. Studies of courtroom behavior reveal that when jurors don't like a witness, they turn their feet toward the nearest exit. From the waist up, the jurors politely face the witness who is speaking, but will turn their feet toward the natural escape route, such as the door leading to the hallway or the jury room. What is true for jurors in a courtroom is also true for person-to-person interactions in general. From the hips up, we will face the person with whom we are talking. But if we are displeased with the conversation, our feet will shift away toward the nearest exit. When a person turns his feet away, it is normally a sign of disengagement, a desire to distance himself from where he is currently positioned. When you are talking with someone and you note that he gradually or suddenly shifts his feet away from you, this is information you need to process. Why did the behavior take place? Sometimes it is a signal that the person is late for an appointment and really has to go. Other times it is a sign that the person no longer wants to be around you. Perhaps you have said something offensive or done something annoying. The shifting foot behavior is a sign that the person wants to depart, shown in Figure 18 of the PDF. However, now it is up to you, based on the circumstances surrounding the behavior, to determine why the individual is anxious to go. How feet wave goodbye. When two people talk to each other, they normally speak toe to toe. If, however, one of the individuals turns his feet slightly away or repeatedly moves one foot in an outward direction, in an L formation with one foot toward you and one away from you, you can be assured he wants to take leave or wishes he were somewhere else. This type of foot behavior is another example of an intention cue. The person's torso may remain facing you out of social diligence, but the feet may more honestly reflect the limbic brain's need or desire to escape. Look again at Figure 18. Recently, I was with a client who had spent almost 5 hours with me. As we were parting for the evening, we reflected on what we had covered that day. Even though our conversation was very collegial, I noticed that my client was holding one leg at a right angle to his body, seemingly wanting to take off on its own. At that point, I said, "You really do have to leave now, don't you?" "Yes," he admitted. "I'm so sorry. I didn't want to be rude, but I have to call London, and I only have 5 minutes." Here was a case where my client's language and most of his body revealed nothing but positive feelings. His feet, however, were the most honest communicators, and they clearly told me that as much as he wanted to stay, duty was calling. The knee clasp. There are other examples of intention movements of the legs that are associated with an individual who wants to leave his current location. Take note of a person who is sitting down, places both hands on his knees in a knee clasp, shown in Figure 19. This is a very clear sign that in his mind, he is ready to conclude the meeting and take leave. Usually this hands-on-knees gesture is followed by a forward lean of the torso and or a shift of the lower body to the edge of the chair, both intention movements. When you note these cues, particularly when they come from your superiors, it's time to end your interaction. Be astute and don't linger. Gravity-defying behaviors of the feet. When we are happy and excited, we walk as if we are floating on air. We see this with lovers enthralled to be around each other, as well as with children who are eager to enter a theme park. Gravity seems to hold no boundaries for those who are excited. These behaviors are quite obvious, and yet every day, all around us, gravity-defying behaviors seemingly elude our observation. When we are excited about something or feel very positive about our circumstances, we tend to defy gravity by doing such things as rocking up and down on the balls of our feet or walking with a bit of a bounce in our step. This is the limbic brain, once again manifesting itself in our nonverbal behaviors. Recently, I was watching a stranger talk on his cell phone. As he listened, his left foot, which had been resting flat on the ground, changed position. The heel of the foot remained on the ground, but the rest of his shoe moved up, so that his toes were pointing skyward. See figure 20. To the average person, that behavior would have gone unnoticed or been disregarded as insignificant. But to the trained observer, that gravity-defying foot behavior can be readily decoded to mean that the man on the phone had just heard something positive. Sure enough, as I walked by, I could hear him say, "Really? That's terrific." His feet had already silently said the same thing. Even when standing still, a person telling a story may inch up to a taller stance, elevating himself to emphasize his points, and he may do so repeatedly. The individual does this subconsciously. Therefore, these elevating behaviors are very honest cues, since they tend to be true expressions of the emotion attached to the story. They appear in real time along with the storyline and relate his feelings along with his words. Just as we move our feet to the beat and tempo of a song we like, so too will we move our feet and legs in congruence with something positive we say. Interestingly, gravity-defying behaviors of the feet and legs are rarely seen in people suffering from clinical depression. The body reflects precisely the emotional state of the individual. So when people are excited, we tend to see many more gravity-defying behaviors. Can gravity-defying behaviors be faked? I suppose they can be, particularly by really good actors and perennial liars. But average people simply don't know how to regulate their limbic behaviors. When people try to control their limbic reactions or gravity-defying behaviors, it looks contrived. Either they appear too passive or restrained for the situation, or not animated enough. A faked upward arm greeting just doesn't cut it. It looks fake, because the arms are not up for very long, and usually the elbows are bent. The gesture has all the hallmarks of being contrived. True gravity-defying behaviors are usually a very good barometer of a person's positive emotional state, and they look genuine. One type of gravity-defying behavior that can be very informative to the astute observer is known as the starter's position, shown in figure 21 of the PDF. This is an action in which a person moves his or her feet from a resting position, flat on the ground, to a ready or starter's position, with heel elevated and weight on the balls of the feet. This is an intention cue that tells us the person is getting ready to do something physical, requiring foot movement. It could mean the individual intends to engage you further, is really interested, or wants to leave. As with all nonverbal intention cues, once you learn a person is about to do something, you need to rely on the context and what you know about the individual to make your best assessment of what that something is going to be. Leg splay. The most unmistakable and easily spotted foot and leg behaviors are territorial displays. Most mammals, human or not, can become territorial when they are stressed or upset, when they are being threatened, or conversely, when they are threatening others. In each case, they will exhibit behaviors indicating they are trying to reestablish control of their situation and their territory. Law enforcement and military personnel use these behaviors because they are accustomed to being in charge. Sometimes they will try to outdo each other, at which point it becomes farcical, as each person tries to splay out wider than his colleagues in a subconscious attempt to claim more territory. When people find themselves in confrontational situations, their feet and legs will splay out, not only for greater balance, but also to claim greater territory. This sends out a very strong message to the careful observer that at a minimum there are issues afoot or that there is potential for real trouble. When two people face off in disagreement, you will never see their legs crossed so that they are off balance. The limbic brain simply will not allow this to take place. If you observe a person's feet going from being together to being spread apart, you can be fairly confident that the individual is becoming increasingly unhappy. This dominant stance communicates very clearly, something is wrong and I am ready to deal with it. Territorial leg splays signal the potential for tempers to flare. Thus, whether you find yourself observing or using this type of nonverbal behavior, you should be on the alert for possible trouble. Because people often assume a more splayed posture when an argument escalates, I tell executives as well as law enforcement officers that one way to defuse a confrontation is to avoid using such territorial displays. If we catch ourselves in a leg splay posture during a heated exchange and immediately bring our legs together, it often lessens the confrontation level and reduces the tension. A few years ago, while I was conducting a seminar, a woman in the audience spoke about how her ex-husband used to intimidate her during an argument by standing in the doorway of their house, legs splayed, blocking her exit. This is not a behavior to be taken lightly. It resonates visually as well as viscerally and can be used to control, intimidate, and threaten. In fact, predators, that is, psychopaths, antisocials, often use this leg splay behavior in conjunction with eye gaze behavior to control others. As one prison inmate once told me, in here, it's all about posture, how we stand, how we look. We can't look weak, not for one moment. I suspect anywhere we might encounter predators, we should be cognizant of our posture and stance. There are, of course, times when a leg splay can be used to your advantage, specifically when you want to establish authority and control over others for a positive reason. I have had to coach female law enforcement officers to use the leg splay to establish a more aggressive stance when responding to unruly crowds in the line of duty. Standing with their feet together, which is perceived as submissive, sends the wrong kind of signal to a would-be antagonist. By moving their feet apart, the female officers can take a more dominant, I am in charge stance, which will be perceived as more authoritarian and thus help them to be more effective in controlling unruly individuals. You may want to emphasize to a teenage son how you feel about smoking, not by raising your voice, but rather by using a territorial display. The territorial imperative. When discussing leg splay and territorial claims, we must recognize the work of Edward Hall, who studied the use of space in humans and other animals. By studying what he termed the territorial imperative, he was able to document our spatial needs, which he referred to as proxemics. Hall found that the more advantaged we are socioeconomically or hierarchically, the more territory we demand. He also found that people who tend to take up more space, territory, through their daily activities also tend to be more self-assured, more confident, and of course, more likely to be of higher status. This phenomenon has been demonstrated throughout human history and in most cultures. In fact, the conquistadors witnessed it when they arrived in the New World. Once here, they saw the same territorial displays in the people native to the Americas that they had seen in Queen Isabella's court. To wit, royalty, in any country, can command and is afforded greater space. While CEOs, presidents, and high-status individuals can claim greater space, for the rest of us, it is not so easy. All of us, however, are very protective of our personal space, regardless of its size. We don't like it when people stand too close. In his research, Edward Hall found that each of us has a space requirement he called proxemics, that is both personal and cultural in origin. When people violate that space, we have powerful limbic reactions indicative of stress. Violations of personal space cause us to become hypervigilant. Our pulse races, and we may become flushed. Just think about how you feel when someone gets too close, whether in a crowded elevator or while you're conducting a transaction at an ATM machine. I mention these space issues so that the next time someone stands too close or you violate someone's space, you are aware of the negative limbic arousal that will take place. Feet and leg displays of high comfort. Careful observation of the legs and feet can help you determine how comfortable you are around someone else and vice versa. Leg crossing is a particularly accurate barometer of how comfortable we feel around another person. We don't use it if we feel uncomfortable. See Figure 22. We also cross our legs in the presence of others when we are confident, and confidence is part of comfort. Let's examine why this is such an honest and revealing lower limb behavior. When you cross one leg in front of the other while standing, you reduce your balance significantly. From a safety standpoint, if there were a real threat, you could neither freeze very easily nor run away, because in that stance, you are basically balanced on one foot. For this reason, the limbic brain allows us to perform this behavior only when we feel comfortable or confident. If a person is standing by herself in an elevator with one leg crossed over the other, she will immediately uncross her legs and plant both feet firmly on the floor when a stranger steps into the elevator. This is a sign that the limbic brain is saying, you can't take any chances. You may have to deal with a potential threat or problem now, so put both feet firmly on the ground. When I see two colleagues talking to each other, and they both have their legs crossed, I know they are comfortable with each other. First, this shows a mirroring of behaviors between two individuals, a comfort sign known as isopraxism, and second, because leg crossing is a high comfort display. This is demonstrated in Figure 23. This leg-crossed nonverbal can be used in interpersonal relationships to let the other person know that things are good between the two of you, so good, in fact, that you can afford to relax totally, limbically, around that individual. Leg-crossing, then, becomes a great way to communicate a positive sentiment. Recently, I attended a party in Coral Gables, Florida, where I was introduced to two women, both of whom were in their early 60s. During the introduction, one of the women suddenly crossed her legs so that she was on one foot leaning toward her friend. I commented, "You ladies must have known each other for a long time." Their eyes and faces lit up, and one asked how I knew this. I said, "Even though you were meeting me, a stranger, for the first time, one of you crossed your legs to favor the other. That is very unusual, unless you really like and trust each other." They both giggled, and one inquired, "Can you read minds, too?" To which I laughed and answered, "No." After I had explained what gave their long-term friendship away, one of the two women confirmed they had known each other since they were in grade school in Cuba in the 40s. Once again, the leg cross proved to be an accurate barometer of human sentiments. Here's an interesting feature of leg crossing. We usually do it subconsciously in favor of the person we like the most. In other words, we cross our legs in such a way so that we tilt toward the person we favor. This can provide some interesting revelations during family gatherings. In families in which there are multiple children, it is not unusual to have a parent reveal a preference for one child over another by crossing legs so that they tilt toward the child they favor. Be aware that sometimes criminals, when they are up to no good, will lean against a wall with their legs crossed when they see police driving by, pretending to be cool. Because this behavior goes counter to the threat the limbic brain is sensing, these criminals usually don't hold this behavior for very long. Experienced officers on the beat can immediately see that these subjects are posing, not reposing. But to the unknowing, they may look erroneously benign. Feet and leg displays during courtship. During high-comfort social interactions, Our feet and legs will mirror those of the other person we are with, isopraxis, and will remain playful. In fact, in the extreme stages of comfort during courtship, the feet will also engage the other person through subtle foot touches or caresses. During courtship, and particularly while seated, a woman will often play with her shoes and dangle them from the tips of her toes when she feels comfortable with her companion. This behavior will, however, quickly cease if the woman suddenly feels uncomfortable. A potential suitor can get a pretty good reading on how things are going based on this shoe play behavior. If, upon approaching a woman, or after talking with her for a while, her shoe play stops, she adjusts her shoe back on her foot, and especially if she follows this by turning slightly away from the suitor and perhaps gathering up her purse, well, in the language of baseball, that suitor has most likely just struck out. Even when a woman is not touching her suitor with her foot, this type of foot dangling and shoe play is movement, and movement draws attention. Therefore, this nonverbal behavior says, "Notice me," which is just the opposite of the freeze response, and is part of the orienting reflex that is instinctive and draws us nearer to the things and people we like or desire, and away from those things we don't like, don't trust, or of which we are not sure. Seated leg crosses are also revealing. When people sit side by side, the direction of their leg crosses become significant. If they are on good terms, the top leg crossed over will point toward the other person. If a person doesn't like a topic his companion brings up, he will switch the position of the legs so that the thigh becomes a barrier, as shown in figures 24 and 25 on the PDF. Such blocking behavior is another meaningful example of the limbic brain protecting us. If there is congruence in the way both parties are sitting and crossing their legs, then there is harmony. Getting a toehold on romance. I was in Los Angeles this year giving nonverbal communication training to a client who works in the television industry. He was kind enough to take me to dinner at a popular Mexican restaurant near his house. While there, he wanted to continue learning about body language and pointed to a couple seated at a nearby table. He asked, "Based on what you see, do you think they're getting along with each other?" As we observed the two diners, we noted that at first they were leaning into each other. But as the dinner and conversation progressed, they both leaned back in their chairs away from each other, not really saying much. My client thought things were going sour between them. I said, "Don't just look above the table, look under the table as well." This was easy to do, as there was no tablecloth or other obstacle blocking the underside of the table. "Notice how their feet are very close to each other," I pointed out. If they weren't getting along, their feet would not be that close together. The limbic brain simply would not allow it. Now that I had him focused on the couple's feet, we noticed that every once in a while, their feet touched or brushed against each other, and neither person's legs retracted. "That behavior is important," I noted. "It shows they still feel connected." When the couple got up to leave, the man put his arm around the woman's waist, and they walked out without saying another word. The nonverbals said it all, even though they were not in a talking mood. If you have ever wondered why there is so much leg-touching and flirting under tables or in swimming pools, it is probably related to two phenomena. First, when our body parts are out of sight, such as under a table or under water or under the covers, they seem out of mind, or at least out of the realm of observation. We have all seen people act in a public pool as if they were in private. Second, our feet contain a tremendous number of sensory receptors, the pathways of which terminate in an area of the brain that is close to the place in which sensations of the genitalia are registered. People play footsies under the table because it feels good and can be very sexually arousing. Conversely, when we don't like someone or don't feel close to them, we move our feet away immediately if they accidentally touch beneath the table. As a relationship wanes, a very clear sign couples often miss is that there will be progressively less foot touching of any kind. Our need for space. Ever wonder what kind of first impression you've made on someone? Whether they seem to like you from the outset, or rather, if there could be difficulties brewing? One way to find out is the shake and wait approach. Here's how it works. Foot and leg behavior is especially important to observe when you first meet people. It reveals a lot about how they feel about you. Personally, when I first meet someone, I typically lean in, give the person a hearty handshake, depending on the appropriate cultural norms in the situation, make good eye contact, and then take a step back and see what happens next. One of three responses is likely to take place. A. The person will remain in place, which lets me know he or she is comfortable at that distance. B. The individual will take a step back or turn slightly away, which lets me know he or she needs more space or wants to be elsewhere. Or C. The person will actually take a step closer to me, which means he or she feels comfortable and or favorable toward me. I take no offense to the individual's behavior, because I am simply using this opportunity to see how he or she really feels about me. Remember, the feet are the most honest part of the body. If a person needs extra space, I give it. If he or she is comfortable, I don't have to worry about dealing with a proximity issue. If someone takes a step toward me, I know they feel more comfortable near me. This is useful information in any social setting. But also remember, you should set limits as to what makes you comfortable when it comes to space. Walking style. When it comes to the feet and legs, I would be remiss if I didn't mention the nonverbal cues given off by different styles of walking. According to Desmond Morris, scientists recognize approximately 40 different styles of walking. If that seems like a lot, just recall what you know about the gait of these individuals as portrayed in various films. Charlie Chaplin, John Wayne, Mae West, or Groucho Marx. Each of these movie characters has a distinctive walking style, and their personalities were revealed, in part, through their gaits. How we walk often reflects our moods and attitudes. We can walk briskly and intentionally, or slowly in a bewildered state. We can stroll, amble, saunter, plod, waddle, limp, shuffle, prowl, bustle, march, promenade, tiptoe, swagger, and so on, to name just a few of the recognized walking styles. For observers of nonverbals, these walking styles are important because changes in the way people normally walk can reflect changes in their thoughts and emotions. A person who is normally happy and gregarious might suddenly change his or her walking style when told a loved one has been injured. Bad or tragic news may cause a person to sprint out of a room in desperation to help out, or it may cause the individual to walk out phlegmatically, as though the weight of the world is on his or her shoulders. Changes in walking style are important nonverbal behaviors, because they warn us that something might be amiss, that a problem might be lurking, that circumstances might have changed, in short, that something significant might have occurred. A change tells us that we need to assess why the person's gait has suddenly changed, particularly since such information can often aid us in dealing more effectively with that individual in upcoming interactions. A person's walk can help us detect things he or she is unknowingly revealing. Crime shoppers. Criminals don't always realize just how much information they give away. When I worked in New York City, my fellow agents and I often watched street predators as they tried to blend into the crowd. One of the ways in which they were unsuccessful in doing so, however, was that they frequently walked on the inside of the sidewalk, habitually changing their walking speed as they aimlessly window shopped. Most people have a place to go and a task to accomplish, so they walk with purpose. Predators, muggers, drug dealers, thieves, con men, lurk about, waiting for their next victim. Therefore, Their postures and pace are different. There is no purposeful direction to their travel until they are about to strike. When a predator vectors toward you, whether a beggar or a mugger, the discomfort you sense is due to the calculations your limbic brain is performing to try to prevent you from becoming the next target. So next time you're in a big city, keep an eye out for predators. If you see a person walking around with no purpose, who suddenly makes a beeline for you, look out. Better yet, get out as quickly as possible. Even if you just sense this is happening, listen to your inner voice. Cooperative versus non-cooperative feet. If you are dealing with a person who is socializing or cooperative with you, his or her feet should mirror your own. If, however, someone's feet are pointed away from you while his body faces toward you, you should ask yourself why. Despite the direction of the body, this is not a genuine cooperation profile and is indicative of several things that must be explored. Such a pose reflects either the person's need to leave or get away soon, a disinterest in what is being discussed, an unwillingness to further assist, or a lack of commitment to what is being said. Note that when someone we don't know approaches us on the street, we usually turn our attention to them from the hips up, but keep our feet pointed in the direction of travel. The message we are sending is that socially, I will be attentive briefly. Personally, I am prepared to continue or flee. Over the years, I have conducted training for customs inspectors in the United States and abroad. I have learned an incredible amount from them, and I hope they have picked up a few pointers from me. One thing I have taught them is to look for passengers who point their feet toward the exit while turning to the officer to make their customs declaration, as shown in Figure 26 on the PDF. While they could simply be in a hurry to catch a flight, this behavior should make the inspector suspicious. In studies, we found that people who make affirmative declarations, such as, "I have nothing to declare, officer," but have their feet turned away, are more likely to be concealing something they should have declared. In essence, their faces are obliging, their words are definitive, but their feet reveal they are being less than cooperative. Significant change in intensity of foot and/or leg movement. Leg twitching and movement is normal. Some people do it all the time, others never. It is not indicative of lying, as some erroneously believe, as both honest and dishonest people will twitch and jiggle. The key factor to consider is at what point do these behaviors start or change? For instance, years ago, Barbara Walters was interviewing Academy Awards nominee Kim Basinger prior to the awards ceremony. Throughout the interview, Miss Basinger jiggled her feet and her hands seemed to be very nervous. When Miss Walters began to ask Miss Basinger about some financial difficulties and a questionable investment she and her then-husband had made, Miss Basinger's foot went from jiggling to kicking. It was instantaneous and remarkable. Again, this does not mean she was lying or even intended to lie in response to the question. But it was clearly a visceral reaction to a negative stimulus, the question asked, and it reflected her disdain for the inquiry. Anytime there is a shift from foot jiggling to foot kicking in a seated person, according to Dr. Joe Kulis, it is a very good indicator that the person has seen or heard something negative and is not happy about it, as the diagram shows in Figure 27 of the PDF. While jiggling may be a show of nervousness, kicking is a subconscious way of combating the unpleasant. The beauty of this behavior is that it is automatic, and most people don't even recognize they are doing it. You can use this nonverbal body signal to your advantage by creating questions that will evince the leg kick response or any other dramatic change in nonverbals, to determine what specific inquiries or subjects are problematic. In this manner, even hidden facts may be elicited from people, whether they answer the question or not. Forget Bonnie. Find Clyde. I vividly recall an interview I conducted with a woman who was thought to be a witness to a serious crime. For hours, the interview session was going nowhere. It was frustrating and tedious. The interviewee revealed no significant behaviors. However, I did notice she jiggled her foot all the time. Because it was a relative constant, this behavior was of no consequence until I asked the question, "Do you know Clyde?" Immediately upon hearing that question, and even though she didn't answer, at least not verbally, the woman's foot went from jiggling to an elevated up and down kicking motion. This was a significant clue that this name had a negative effect on her. In further questioning, she later admitted that Clyde had involved her in stealing government documents from a base in Germany. Her leg kick reaction was a significant clue to us that there was something more to explore, and in the end, her confession proved that suspicion to be accurate. Ironically, that betraying behavior probably made her want to kick herself, because it ultimately cost her 25 years in a federal prison. Foot freeze. If a person constantly wiggles or bounces his or her feet or leg or legs and suddenly stops, you need to take notice. This usually signifies that the individual is experiencing stress, an emotional change, or feels threatened in some way. Ask yourself why the person's limbic system kicked their survival instincts into the freeze mode. Perhaps something was said or asked that might lead to revealing information the person doesn't want you to know. Possibly the individual has done something and is afraid you will find him out. The foot freeze is another example of a limbic-controlled response, the tendency of an individual to stop activity when faced with danger. The foot lock and leave. When an individual suddenly turns his toes inward or interlocks his feet, it is a sign that he is insecure, anxious, and/or feels threatened. When interviewing suspects in crimes, I often notice that they interlock their feet and ankles when they are under stress. A lot of people, especially women, have been taught to sit this way, especially when wearing a skirt. See Figure 28. However, to lock the ankles in this way, especially over a prolonged period, is unnatural and should be considered suspect, particularly when done by males. Interlocking ankles is again part of the limbic response to freeze in the face of a threat. Experienced nonverbal observers have noted how often people who are lying will not move their feet in an interview, seeming frozen, or they interlock their feet in such a way as to restrict movement. This is consistent with research, indicating that people tend to restrict arm and leg movements when lying. Having said this, I want to caution you that lack of movement is not in itself indicative of deception. It is indicative of self-restraint and caution, which both nervous and lying individuals utilize to assuage their concerns. Some individuals take the interlocking feet or ankles one step further. They actually lock their feet around the legs of their chair, as shown in Figure 29. This is a restraining freeze behavior that tells us, once again, that something is troubling the person. Sometimes a person will signal stress by attempting to hide the feet altogether. When you are speaking with someone, watch to see if that individual moves his or her feet from in front of the chair to under the chair. There is no scientific research yet to document what I am about to say. However, over the years, I have observed that when a high-stress question is asked, the respondent will often withdraw his or her feet beneath the chair, which could be seen as a distancing reaction and one that attempts to minimize the exposed parts of the body. This cue can be used to evince discomfort about particular issues and help channel the investigative inquiry. As the observer watches, the interviewee, through his feet and legs, will tell you those things about which he does not wish to talk. As the subject changes and becomes less stressful, the feet will emerge again, expressing the limbic brain's relief that the stressful topic is no longer being discussed. Make that a double freeze. You should always be on the lookout for multiple tells, tell clusters, that point to the same behavioral conclusion. They strengthen the likelihood that your conclusion is correct. In the case of the foot lock, watch for the individual who locks his feet around his chair legs and then moves his hand along his pants leg, as if drying his hand on his trousers. The foot lock is a freeze response, and the leg rubbing is a pacifying behavior. The two, taken together, make it more likely that the person has been uncovered. He fears something he has done will be found out, and he is experiencing stress because of this. Summing it up. Because they have been so directly critical to our survival throughout human evolution, our feet and legs are the most honest parts of the body. Our lower limbs provide the most accurate, uncensored information to the alert observer. Used skillfully, this information can help you get a better read on others in all manner of settings. When you combine your knowledge of foot and leg nonverbals with signals from other parts of the body, you become even more capable of understanding what people are thinking, feeling, and intending to do. Therefore, let's turn our attention to those other parts of the body now. Next stop, the human torso. 4. Torso tips. Nonverbals of the torso, hips, chest, and shoulders. This chapter will cover the hips, abdomen, chest, and shoulders, collectively known as the torso or trunk. As with the legs and feet, many of the behaviors associated with the torso reflect the true sentiments of the emotional limbic brain. Because the torso houses many vital internal organs, such as the heart, lungs, liver, and digestive tract, we can anticipate that the brain will seek to diligently protect this area when threatened or challenged. During times of danger, whether real or perceived, the brain recruits the rest of the body to guard these crucial organs in ways that range from the subtle to the more obvious. Let's look at some of the more common nonverbal signals of the torso and some examples of how these behaviors project what is going on in the brain, particularly the limbic brain. Significant nonverbal behaviors involving the torso, hips, chest, and shoulders. The torso lean. Like much of our body, the torso will react to perceived dangers by attempting to distance itself from anything stressful or unwanted. For instance, when an object is thrown at us, our limbic system sends signals to the torso to move away instantly from that threat. Typically, this will happen regardless of the nature of the object. If we sense movement in our direction, we will pull away, whether from a baseball or a moving car. In a similar fashion, when an individual is standing next to someone who is being obnoxious, or someone he does not like, his torso will lean away from that individual. Because the torso carries a large portion of our weight, and transmits it to the lower limbs, any reorientation of our trunks requires energy and balance. Therefore, when one's torso does lean away from something, it is because the brain demands it. So we can count on the honesty of these reactions. Extra effort and energy are required to hold these positions. Just try to maintain any off-center position consciously, whether bowing down or leaning away, and you will find that your body soon tires. However, when such off-balance behavior is performed because your brain subconsciously decides it's a necessity, you'll hardly feel it or notice it. Not only do we lean away from people who make us uncomfortable, we may also blade away, turn slightly, by degrees, from that which does not appeal to us or we grow to dislike. Not long after it opened, I took my daughter to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., which is something every visitor to D.C. should do. As we walked around the memorable exhibits, I noticed how young and old first approached each exhibit. Some walked right up, leaning into it while trying to absorb every nuance. Some approached hesitantly, while others would draw near, then begin to turn slowly and slightly away, as the inhumanity of the Nazi regime encroached on their senses. Some, stunned by the depravity they were witnessing, turned 180 degrees and faced the other way as they waited for their friends to finish examining the display. Their brains were saying, "I can't handle this," and so their bodies turned away. The human species has evolved to the point that not only physical proximity to a person we dislike can cause us to lean away, but even images of unpleasant things, such as photographs, can cause a torso lean. As a careful observer of human behavior, you need to be aware that distancing sometimes takes place abruptly or very subtly. A mere shifting of body angle of just a few degrees is enough to express negative sentiment. For example, couples who are pulling apart emotionally will also begin to pull apart physically. Their hands don't touch as much, and their torsos actually avoid each other. When they sit side by side, they will lean away from each other. They create a silent space between them. And when they are forced to sit next to each other, such as in the back of an automobile, they will only rotate toward each other with their heads, not their bodies. Wily or weird? Years ago, I was stationed in the New York office of the FBI. During my tenure there, I had numerous opportunities to ride the trains and subways in and out of the city. It didn't take long to recognize the many different techniques people used to claim territory while on public transport. It seemed there was always someone who sat on the seat, but whose body would sway from side to side so as to impose on others, or whose arms would flail wildly at times while holding one of the straps. These individuals always seemed to possess more space around them, because no one wanted to get near them. When forced to sit or stand next to these weirdos, people would lean at the torso as far as possible, so as not to come in contact with them. You have to ride the subways in New York to appreciate this. I'm convinced that some passengers purposely acted strangely and exaggerated their body movements to keep people at a distance, away from their torsos. In fact, a longtime resident of New York once told me, "If you want to keep the hordes at bay, act like you're nuts." Perhaps he was right. Ventral denial and ventral fronting. These torso displays that reflect the limbic brain's need to distance and avoid are very good indicators of true sentiments. When one person in a relationship feels that something is wrong with the way things are going, he or she is most likely sensing a subtle degree of physical distancing in his or her partner. The distancing can also take the form of what I call ventral denial. Our ventral front side, where our eyes, mouth, chest, breasts, genitals, etc. are located, is very sensitive to things we like and dislike. When things are good, we expose our ventral sides toward what we favor, including those people who make us feel good. When things go wrong, relationships change, or even when topics are discussed that we disfavor, we will engage in ventral denial by shifting or turning away. The ventral side is the most vulnerable side of the body, so the limbic brain has an inherent need to protect it from the things that hurt or bother us. This is the reason, for example, we immediately and subconsciously begin to turn slightly to the side when someone we dislike approaches us at a party. When it comes to courtship, an increase in ventral denial is one of the best indicators that the relationship is in trouble. In addition to visual input, the limbic brain can also have a reaction to conversations we find distasteful. Watch any TV talk show with the volume off and notice how the guests will lean away from each other as they present contrary arguments. Not long ago, I was watching the Republican presidential debates and noted that even though the candidates were spaced quite far apart, they still leaned away from each other when issues were brought up with which they disagreed. The opposite of ventral denial is ventral exposure, or, as I like to call it, ventral fronting. We display our ventral sides to those we favor. When our children come running to us for a hug, we move objects, even our arms, out of the way so that we can give them access to our ventral sides. We ventrally front this because this is where we feel the most warmth and comfort. In fact, We use the phrase turning our back to express negativity towards someone or something, because we offer our ventral sides to those we care for and our backs to those we don't. Similarly, we demonstrate comfort by using our torsos and shoulders to lean in the direction of that which we favor. In a classroom, it's not unusual to see students leaning toward a favorite teacher without realizing they are bent forward, almost out of their chairs, hanging on every word. Remember the scene from the movie Raiders of the Lost Ark, when the students were leaning forward to hear their professor? Their nonverbal behavior clearly indicated they admired him. Lovers can be seen leaning across a cafe table, their faces coming close to each other, to gain more intimate visual contact. They front their ventral selves toward each other, exposing their most vulnerable parts. This is a natural evolutionary response of the limbic brain that has social benefit. By moving closer together and exposing our ventral, weakest side when we like someone or something, we show that we are giving ourselves in an unrestrained manner. Reciprocating this positioning by mirroring or isopraxism demonstrates social harmony by rewarding the intimacy and showing it is appreciated. Nonverbal limbic behaviors of the torso, such as leaning, distancing, and ventral exposure or denial, happen all the time in boardrooms and other meetings. Colleagues who share a similar point of view will sit closer together, turn more toward each other ventrally, and will lean harmoniously nearer each other. When people disagree, they will hold their bodies firm, avoid ventral fronting unless challenged, and will most likely lean away from each other. See figures 30 and 31 on the PDF. This behavior subconsciously tells others, "I am not in agreement with your idea." As with all nonverbals, these actions need to be analyzed in context. For example, people new to a job may seem stiff and inflexible at a meeting. Rather than reflecting dislike or disagreement, this rigid posture and limited arm activity may simply indicate that they are nervous in a new environment. Not only can we use this information to read the body language of others, but we must also always remember that we are projecting our own nonverbals. During conversations or meetings, as information and opinions flow, our feelings about the news and viewpoints also will flow and will be reflected in our ever-changing nonverbal behaviors. If we hear something distasteful one minute and something favorable the next, our bodies will reflect this shift in our feelings. A very powerful way to let others know that you agree with them or are consciously contemplating what they are saying is to lean toward them or to ventrally front them. This tactic is especially effective when you are in a meeting and you don't have the opportunity to speak up. The torso shield. When it is impractical or socially unacceptable to lean away from someone or something we dislike, we often subconsciously use our arms or objects to act as barriers, as demonstrated in Figure 32. Clothing or nearby objects also serve the same purpose. For instance, a businessman may suddenly decide to button his jacket when talking to someone with whom he is uncomfortable, only to undo the jacket as soon as the conversation is over. Buttoning a jacket, of course, is not always an indication of discomfort. Often men will button their jackets to formalize a setting or to show deference to their boss. It is not the kind of total comfort we might find at, say, a barbecue, but neither does it indicate uneasiness. Clothing and how we attend to our clothes can influence perceptions and are even suggestive of how approachable or open we are to others. It has always been my impression that presidents often go to Camp David to accomplish in polo shirts what they can't seem to accomplish in business suits 40 miles away at the White House. By unveiling themselves ventrally, with the removal of coats, they are saying, "I am open to you." Presidential candidates send this same nonverbal message at rallies when they get rid of their jackets, their shields, if you will, and roll up their shirt sleeves in front of the common folk. Perhaps not surprisingly, women tend to cover their torsos even more so than men, especially when they feel insecure, nervous, or cautious. A woman may cross her arms over her stomach, just under the breasts, in an effort to shield her torso and comfort herself. She may cross one arm across her front and grab the opposite arm at the elbow, forming a barrier to her chest. Both behaviors subconsciously serve to protect and insulate, especially in social situations where there is some discomfort. On campus, I often see women place their notebooks across their chests as they walk into class, particularly for the first few days. As their comfort level increases, they will shift to carrying their notebooks at their sides. On test days, this chest-shielding behavior tends to increase, even among male students. Women will also use backpacks, briefcases, or purses to shield themselves, especially when sitting alone. Just as you may pull a comforter on while watching television, putting something across the ventral torso protects and soothes us. Objects we draw toward us, especially ventrally, are usually placed there to provide the comfort we need at that moment, whatever the situation. When you witness people protecting their torsos in real time, you can use it as an accurate indicator of discomfort on their parts. By carefully assessing the circumstances, the source of that discomfort may allow you to help them or at least better understand them. Pillow talk. When we see individuals suddenly protecting their torsos, we can assume they are not comfortable and that they sense themselves to be in some kind of threatening or dangerous situation. In 1992, while working with the FBI, I interviewed a young man and his father in a hotel room in the Boston area. The father had agreed, reluctantly, to bring the young man to the interview. While sitting on the hotel couch, the young man grabbed one of the couch pillows and held it close to his chest for most of the 3-hour interview. Despite the presence of his father, this young man felt vulnerable and, therefore, needed to tightly clutch a security blanket. While the barrier was only a pillow, it must have been quite effective for this individual, because there was just no getting through to him. I found it remarkable that when the subject was neutral, such as when we talked about his involvement in sports, he would put the pillow aside. However, when we spoke of his possible complicity in a major crime, he would retrieve the pillow and press it tightly against his torso. It was clear that the only time his limbic brain felt the need to protect his torso was when he felt threatened. He never did reveal anything at this meeting, but the next time he was interviewed, the comforting pillows were conspicuously absent. Men, for whatever the reason, perhaps to be less conspicuous, will shield their torsos, but in more subtle ways. A male may reach across the front of himself to play with his watch, or, as Prince Charles of England often does when he is in public, reach over and adjust his shirt sleeve or play with his cufflinks. A man may also fix his tie knot, perhaps longer than usual, as this allows for the arm to cover the ventral area of the chest and neck. These are forms of shielding that transmit that the person is slightly insecure at that moment. I was in a supermarket checkout line waiting for the woman in front of me to conclude her transaction. She was evidently using a debit card, and the machine kept rejecting it. Each time she swiped the card and entered her PIN number, she would await the machine's response with her arms crossed across her chest, until finally she gave up and walked away, exasperated. Each time the card was rejected, her arms and grip got tighter, a clear sign that her annoyance and discomfort were escalating, as shown in figures 33 and 34 of the PDF. Children can be seen to cross or lock their arms across their bodies when upset or being defiant, even at an early age. These shielding behaviors come in a variety of forms, from arms crisscrossed over the belly to crossing the arms high with hands grasping opposite shoulders. Students often ask me if it means there is something wrong with them if they sit in class and cross their arms in front of themselves. The question is not whether something is wrong, nor does this posture mean they are blocking the teacher out. Arms intertwined across the front is a very comfortable pose for many people. However, when a person suddenly crosses arms and then interlocks them